Today's broadcast comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. This year marks the bicentennial of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and on the program this afternoon, we're going to take a look at the story of the expedition through the experience of the native peoples Lewis and Clark encountered. Our guest is University of Illinois historian Frederick Hoxie. He is the Swanland Professor of History at the U of I and the author of several books about American Indian history. He's also the curator of an exhibit, Lewis and Clark in the Indian Country, now at the Newberry Library in Chicago. The Newberry Library exhibition is the only Chicago-area exhibit dedicated to the Lewis and Clark expedition during the bicentennial. The free public exhibition opened this past fall. It continues through January 14, 2006. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. WILL. If you're listening outside the local dialing area, use our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Professor Hoxie was a founding trustee of the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian. He has served as consultant to the U.S. Department of Justice, the U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs, the National Park Service, and the Cheyenne River and Standing Rock Sioux tribes. 333-9455, the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area if you'd like to join the discussion. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Hoxie, welcome.
Thank you.
I suspect this approach to the expedition of Meriwether Lewis and William Clark is one that has not been taken very often, if ever before. That is, looking at the expedition through the experience of the indigenous peoples that Lewis and Clark encountered. What do we gain when we take a look at the story from this point of view?
Well, we gain a couple of things. I think we gain, first of all, of course, the accuracy of the story. One of the principal consequences of the way the story has been traditionally told has been, and it's not so surprising that it would have been told this way, by telling the story by focusing on the two captains and this company of American soldiers who traveled across North America. There's a tendency to focus on the hardships and the struggles and the difficulty and the courage of these people. But in the process of doing that, it's sort of like focusing a camera on one spot of the picture and losing focus of the other spot. And when people lose focus on the other spot, they tend to kind of assume certain things. And one of the assumptions that's been made, and I think the principal assumption that this exhibit illuminates or corrects, is that the land they crossed was a wilderness, that it was empty or that it was somehow backward and hostile and so on. And that's why we came to the title that we did for the exhibit, Lewis and Clark in the Indian Country, that we wanted to focus on this country that was there, not a country in the European sense, but a country of communities, people, trade networks, religious values, family connections, a whole world of people through which they traveled. So the contribution, I hope, of an exhibit like this is to give us a more accurate picture. And then secondly, I think what it does is gives us a I think, something a little deeper and more meaningful to reflect upon in a bicentennial. We've had now a kind of a generation of bicentennials. Every few years, something comes along, a centennial or a bicentennial, and they tend to become very focused on, while they're celebrating an event, they tend to simplify the event at the same time. And I think this, looking at the expedition in this way, allows us to see this as an experience that, you know, has some meaning for our own time. That is, that these were people who were traveling through a different culture, who were making progress by understanding different ways of life and different voices, different people, and really helping us see that our history is not just a story of a small group of our history in the United States is made up of all of these many stories together.
Yeah. One of the things that I started to think about as I started to think about what we might talk about this afternoon and about the Lewis and Clark expedition from the point of view of the Native experience is that, you know, we think of Lewis and Clark as explorers, but it seems to me that there was mutual exploration going on. There was mutual diplomacy going on.
Well, sure. Although there were times when the Indians had the upper hand in this exploration, because the Indian country, this region in 1805, was not only well-traveled by Indian people, but there were British traders well-established on the west coast of North America. There were French-Canadian fur traders and Spanish traders who had crisscrossed all of the country that Lewis and Clark crossed, so that the Indian people they encountered were people who had already encountered Europeans, who were well aware of their weapons and their tools, unfortunately, of the diseases they brought with them. And so often it wasn't, while this was new country for these Virginians who were traveling west for the first time, people like them were not entirely new to many of the people they met.
Yeah. Now, as the expedition party set out, what did it know about the peoples who lived in the West?
Well, one of the really dramatic artifacts in the exhibit at the Newberry Library is a map that was drawn in London in 1803, just before the expedition departed, and it brought together all the known information about the geography of North America. And this map is it's a big map. It's a beautiful map, and it's framed and on the wall in the exhibit. And what it shows is the West Coast very clearly marked, because the George Vancouver expeditions had been up the West Coast in the 1790s. And it shows much of the Hudson Bay area very well marked, because it had been charted and mapped by Hudson Bay Company traders. It shows the Missouri River running up from what's now St. Louis. And then in the middle of North America, it is blank. There is a big empty spot. They knew roughly what the distance was between St. Louis and the West Coast. They knew there were mountains in between. They knew there was a river system, but they didn't know a great deal more than that.
Did they think of it as an inhabited homeland?
Oh, yes. They knew they had to talk and trade and negotiate their way, particularly as they moved up the Missouri River, but really even throughout, they knew that this was going to be something that they couldn't possibly bring enough food, for example, to eat for the 2 or 3 years of the trip. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know specifically how to get there. They knew very well that they were going to have to trade and make friends with people they encountered along the way, and they saw that quite readily. And, you know, when they left from St. Louis, they had reports of people from the area. They had a pretty clear idea of what the geography and what the situation was up through what's now, say, the middle of South Dakota. But beyond that, they knew they needed friends and they knew they needed help, but they didn't know much more than that.
Yeah. Now, Jefferson provided instructions regarding how to interact with Indian people. What were his instructions?
Well, Jefferson was interested in two things. We must remember this was a military expedition. These were army captains. It was all male, except when they got to the Mandan villages and Sacagawea or Sacagawea joined them. Their orders were to explore the route to the west and to record the trading potential of the groups that they encountered along the way. So So it was in many ways a kind of diplomatic and commercial exploration. That is to find, was it commercially viable to travel by land between St. Louis and the Pacific Coast? And the answer to that was no at that point. And was there trading potential among the groups that they encountered along the way? The answer to that one was a big yes, and their reports filed right from the very beginning detailed specific tribes, what they thought they could supply in terms of trade material every year and that sort of thing.
Yeah. How many Native American tribes did the expedition meet?
Oh, you know, that's a hard question. I've been asked that a lot. I think you can probably give a number like 20 or 30, but the word tribe is one that implies a kind of fixed group. You know, you either belong to this group or to that group and so on. And one of the reasons we begin our exhibit, the first section of our exhibit is called The Indian Country, and we try to describe some of the trade networks and so on that I was mentioning earlier, but we also try to describe what the nature of social life was in these communities. And one of the things that was a factor right from the beginning in the encounters between the Americans and the Indians, and also makes it difficult to answer your question, is that these were kinship societies. These were essentially people who felt themselves to be related to one another, who lived in communities, in families, with extended families and clans and so on, who adopted members of other tribes, who traded with groups and so on, so that the boundaries between groups and so on were vague and also permeable. They shifted through time. Our exhibit focuses on six encounters between Lewis and Clark and six different groups whom they encountered along the way. We use those six meetings as a kind of a window onto the different dimensions of their encounter with Native people.
Yeah, but those groups are kind of identified as a group in the way that we think of group. Yes?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And both Indians and whites began to use the term tribe and began to, as their relationships became more formal, they began to have a much a sharper distinction between one group and another.
Yeah. The customs, the kinship that you mentioned, how Indian peoples were bound together. They were bound together by family, by kinship, also by trade and diplomacy. Tell us about the trade and diplomacy, the cultural exchanges that they engaged in.
Sure. One of the things that Europeans often misunderstood about Indians, although I think Lewis and Clark did not, both of them had served in the American Army in the Ohio Valley, and they had had encounters with Indian people, and they understood this element. But, you know, going all the way back to Columbus, arrived, and one of the first things he recorded in his journals was that people came up to him and gave him presents. And he interpreted this as being, well, what generous children of God these are. What he didn't understand was that gift-giving, the exchanging of presents, was a diplomatic tradition among Native people. It actually really stretched across the continent. So the idea of people giving things to each other, of circulating goods back and forth, is a way of establishing relationships. Whereas Europeans might need a treaty or a law or a signed agreement or a contract, what Indian people tended to do was to exchange gifts as a way of establishing a human connection. And again, with this family sense of identity, people often would also adopt children and really become what anthropologists call fictive kin. That is, they would establish sort of quasi-kinship relationships with one another. So in the first winter, which is the first moment that we focus on in the part of the exhibit that discusses the expedition itself, in the winter of 1804 and 1805, the Americans formed a camp. They established a camp next door to a group of agricultural villages on the upper Missouri, not far from where Bismarck, North Dakota, is today. And the Indians thought it was very strange that these people lived separately in their own group and so on. And there was a kind of a struggle, but a tension between Indians wanting to establish kinship, visiting back and forth, sharing and so on, and the Americans wanting to have their own, you know, the military discipline of the people in their camp, and the commanders wanting to keep the soldiers at home and that sort of thing.
Hmm. So did Lewis and Clark, they didn't understand then the concept of gift giving within this culture?
Well, they did understand trade, and they also understood that the Indians were very interested in the metal, steel that they had with them, and very interested in the weapons that they had with them. So they engaged in gift giving to a certain extent. They carried medals with them, which they gave to Indians as a sign of respect to leaders. But one of the things that just as a kind of an example of this, they had flags with them, and they gave them American flags. And so in this first winter, Lewis particularly was the more formal of the two of them. He gave the Mandan leader a flag, and he said, "Now you fly this flag. You cannot fly your British flag anymore." And this made no sense to the Mandan leader. He thought, "Well, we have friends, allies in Great Britain and Canada. We have friends and allies in the United States." And Lewis was saying, "No, this is now part of the United States. You are only going to fly an American flag." And that was a point where they just kind of agreed to disagree. They just didn't get it. Neither one of them really got the other's message on that one.
Yeah. What kinds of things did the Indians give as gifts to Lewis and Clark?
Well, the biggest item was food. The exhibit that I've curated was developed with five Native American consultants, and we might talk about this. It was really a wonderful experience for me of working with five educators from five of the tribes along the Lewis and Clark Trail, and talking about how to present it and what themes to focus on and so on. But one of my consultants came from the Mandan Hidatsa community in what's now North Dakota, and he likes to say that the Mandan Hidatsa had the first Walmart. People in Champaign know about Walmarts all around us. And he said it's like Walmart because we had everything, and we were open 24 hours a day. but these were agricultural communities. They grew corns and beans and squash on the river bottoms along the Missouri River. They hunted buffalo. They also traded for horses and rawhide, finished clothing and buckskin and other sorts of things as well, with other Indians, as well as trading with the British traders. When Lewis and Clark arrived in the upper Missouri, they found French-Canadian traders from Canada already there. And in fact, Charbonneau, the man who had Sacagawea with him, who accompanied the expedition, was one of these traders whom they met in the villages.
Yeah. You mentioned the consultants. I would like you to talk about them and what you learned from them. And I do understand that in the exhibit there are kiosks that you can go into and you can actually hear them talk about the story.
In fact, we have about 30 different individuals whose interviews are in these really terrific kiosks that were. We had the interviews, and we had the idea of wanting to have the interviews and the voices in the gallery somehow, and we were very lucky to find a group in Chicago who were able, with the DVD technology, to create a very easy-to-use interface so that someone can sit down and click on a tribe or click on a topic like women or trade or something, and then you get a menu of different interviews you can listen to and see in front of you on a video kiosk. We developed that in partnership with a group at the University of Montana who were conducting a much larger oral history project on Indians on the Lewis and Clark Trail. But let me just say a couple of things about the consultants. We began this project in 2001 with these consultants and really began with the question of how to proceed, how should we do this. I very much wanted to do this together. Because of the reasons I had said earlier about the way bicentennials tend to go and wanting to focus on the interaction with Indian people. And I learned a lot from them, and I can say some more specifics, but the general message that they wanted communicated, and I hope the exhibit communicates well, is really captured in the very simple word in our title, and that is Lewis and Clark and the Indian Country. What they wanted people to understand is that Lewis and Clark's expedition opened up a relationship between the United States and the Indian peoples of the western part of North America, and that the relationship between the United States and the Indian country is something that began in 1804 and 5 and 6, but also continues into the present, an ongoing relationship. So the exhibit not only has the sections that I mentioned on the Indian country itself and on the expedition, but we have a section on the aftermath of the expedition. And we also have a section on the Indian, that's called the Indian Country Today, where we talk about some of the cultural and educational and other programs that are going on in these communities that attempt to maintain the traditions and values that Lewis and Clark first encountered 200 years ago.
Yeah. In one of the documents prepared for the exhibition that I have seen called Encounters, there's a comment from a member of the Blackfeet, Daryl Robes Kipp, and I'd like to share that with the audience. Most Americans tell themselves a story about Lewis and Clark, about the fact that they were brave explorers and that they discovered the path to the Pacific. We don't dispute that story, but we tell a different one. We tell a story about men who were afraid of us and who made us afraid.
Yeah.
What else do Native Americans have to say to us directly about how Lewis and Clark are remembered in Indian country?
Well, I think what you hear is that when there are some wonderful moments in the history of the expedition, moments when the two groups of people, for whatever reason, rather force or fear, listened to each other and understood each other and got along with each other. And then there are moments when their agendas were different, and particularly the Americans were less interested in listening to the other side, who were impatient. And I think that one of the things that you see in these six encounters that we focus on in the exhibit, but I think in general, is that when their agendas were compatible, the two sides were able to work out a way of being together. But when their agendas were not compatible, and this particularly happened later in the expedition when the Americans were becoming particularly anxious about getting back, particularly fearful of the people they were with, then it sort of brought out the worst in people. And the Blackfeet example that Daryl was referring to was the incident in the summer of 1806 when they met a group of young Blackfeet boys and camped with them. There was a scuffle, and Lewis shot and killed a Blackfeet who was trying to steal some of the Americans' horses, and which had an impact on relations afterwards.
Yeah, that was the first act of bloodshed between the Western Indians and the Lewis and Clark Party.
Yes. And it was a product of misunderstanding in some ways. It was a misunderstanding, and it was also a product of fear of the Americans of being isolated and being attacked, and fear of the Blackfeet, of these people who appeared to be so bold and aggressive. This was There's a very interesting thing that happens in the expedition is that the first half of the expedition is a much more kind of optimistic, positive story, in the sense that because they were in such need of help and direction, they made a real effort to work with, listen to the people they were with on the way back, beginning really on the Oregon coast. And while it wasn't a violent incident, it was a violation of the local code, which was they stole a canoe from a neighboring tribe because they got frustrated with trading with these people, and they felt anxious. They had to hit the road. They had to get going. And they essentially burned their bridges with these people by stealing a canoe and heading upriver. And then the Blackfeet incident occurs later on.
Yeah. And all the way back, were you in a period of deteriorating relations?
Well, it was they were. I think it's better to say that there was always this kind of tension between diplomacy and aggressive kind of American aggressiveness. And the balance tips on the other side. Although on the way back, they also, the last meetings they have are back with the Mandan Hidatsas they had been with a year before, and they really formed a kind of alliance with these people. In part because these were people who were at that time under attack by the Sioux, who were expanding and moving west across the plains, and they felt quite embattled, and they needed help, they needed partners, they needed a source of guns, and they were eager to make friends with the Americans. So it wasn't all negative on the way back, but you can see these two sides much more clearly on the return trip.
Yeah. Trade and food, are those the two things where we can find common ground? Or are there more?
Well, there was a good part of the expedition that was informal. It was people playing music for each other, performing for each other. There's one of our six incidents is the on the upper Columbia River in the spring of 1806. The Americans were eager to get going, but they came up river in the spring, not realizing that the mountain passes in what's now Idaho were all blocked with snow, and there was no way they were going to go over the mountains until June, and this was now April. They spent the month of May essentially camping with different Indian groups on the western slope of the Rockies. And one of our moments is the end of April in 1806. They spend a time with the Umatillas, and we describe an evening where the Indians say to them, "We will dance and sing all night until you come back." And in Clark's journal, he describes this big gathering of people and what we would call a round dance in a powwow today, but people dancing and performing together, the Americans playing their instruments and so on. So there was a lot of that. During the month of one of the pieces in our exhibit is a photograph of William Clark's son, who was a Nez Perce, grew up with the Nez Perce, who was conceived during that month of waiting for the snow to melt. So there were a number of ways in which people got together that were beyond trade and exchange of gifts and food.
Opportunities for after hours.
That's right.
Yeah.
And this was, as I say, one of those moments of tension where the Americans often didn't understand this family connection of drawing them into homes and so on that was a part of the Native tradition and part of a very practical Native tradition of diplomacy and their desire to keep their men in line and so on.
Yeah. At the end of the, by the time it was all over, did they have a better understanding of?
Well, it's interesting, and it's really one of the things that's so fascinating about getting into a subject like this. One of the things that was a delight for me as a curator is that I was able to not only have the help of these consultants, but also the Native consultants that I mentioned, but also spend time looking at not just the Lewis and Clark journals, and Lewis and Clark had very different personalities and attitudes, but also the six other journals that were kept by enlisted men on the expedition. And you have a variety of responses. Some of the men on the expedition, as soon as they got to St. Louis, they turned around, went right back up the river, became fur traders, and lived in the Indian country for the rest of their lives. Lewis was a troubled person, suffered from depression. He never really felt comfortable, it's clear from reading his journals, with Indian people and with this kind of cultural divide. Clark, on the other hand, was very outgoing. He's difficult to read in the journals because his spelling is so terrible. He never went to school. He was essentially illiterate, but he kept a journal anyway. He spent the rest of his career in St. Louis as a kind of the American diplomat, the American agent for Indians in the West. And Indians in the area called St. Louis, they called it Redhead's Town. He was a redheaded man, and they thought of him as a contact, as someone they could trust and so on.
Yeah. You mentioned the story of the stealing of a canoe. Does that story remain part of the Native American story of Lewis and Clark?
That's a really good question. I would say yes and no. The no part is that the group that they encountered in the course of the 19th century were moved by settlers and by government action up the coast and away from this particular place. And in the course of all that disruption, that particular story was lost. But the stories that remain and that are in our kiosks and so on is of people who really didn't, again, I use the expression of listen to, they didn't really appreciate this very unique and new environment that they were in on the Oregon coast. From the American point of view, from the point of view of the captains, this was a miserable winter. None of the Indian languages that they could use because of the men, they had a part Indian, one of the men in the expedition was a part Shawnee man. They had Charbonneau, they had Sacagawea. They had the ability to make contact with three or four different Indian languages, but none of those were intelligible on the western coast. The sign language that they had used didn't work on the western coast. They were in a new environment, this rainy, foggy, damp environment was very foreign to them. And the Indians, and then also the Indians, they who lived there were all trading with the British, and they knew about trade, they knew about trade goods, and they weren't terribly impressed with what the Americans had to offer. So there was this real difficulty on the Americans' part, so that the stories that you hear and the stories that one of the stories that's sort of amusing that's in the exhibit is about how the Americans insisted on wearing buckskin clothing, the kind of clothing they'd worn all along the way, made from deer hides and so on, during this winter. And if you can picture wearing buckskin leggings and shirts in a cold, damp climate where it's essentially raining. When it's not raining, it's so foggy, it might as well be raining. And then living in these small little huts warmed by fires over the winter, their clothes literally rotted off them in the course of the winter. And as they rotted off, they would go out and hunt another deer and make another buckskin shirt and put it back on. And that would rot off. And the Indians, and that's a story that continues, the Indians found that really amusing because they wore cedar hats that were waterproof. They wore a kind of woven cape that really functioned the way a kind of a fleece does today. It was a heavily insulated but very light material. They wore sandals to get in and out of canoes in the wet weather and so on. And they thought the Americans' clothing was something that they just didn't understand.
Yeah, I can imagine it. Somebody turning, one Indian turning to another and saying, get a load of these guys.
Yeah.
Let's talk with a listener. We're going to talk with a listener now who's calling in from Indiana this afternoon. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine, University of Illinois historian Frederick Hoxie. He's the Swanland Professor of History at the U of I, the author of several books about American Indian history. He's also curated an exhibit at the Newberry Library in Chicago, Lewis and Clark and the Indian Country. It runs through January 14th, 2006. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you'd like to join the discussion anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. Listener on line 4 in Indiana, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Why, I understand that the journals were sort of dispersed after the expedition, and they weren't published as a government document until much later. Can you give us a history of the records that were kept?
Sure. You're exactly right, and it's an interesting part of the expedition. They came back in 1806. Lewis died in 1809, and Lewis had the job of writing up a history of the expedition. And after his death, the job fell to Clark, but Clark really didn't have the literary skills to do it. And at Jefferson's urging, it was turned over to a man named Nicholas Biddle in Philadelphia, who produced something called The History of the Expedition in 1814. So there was an early history of the expedition, but what it was taking particularly the captain's journals, and they had one or two others to draw on, and they wrote a third-person history rather than, you know, I met so-and-so, it was they went here and he met this and so on. So that it was an accurate history, but they were not the actual journals. There also were only about 2,500 copies published, and it was not a well-known document, not a well-circulated document. It wasn't until the centennial in 1904 that the director, actually, of the Wisconsin Historical Society published the first journals that were the actual journals of Lewis and Clark. And it isn't until now beginning in the 1990s and completed just a few years ago, the University of Nebraska Press has produced a beautiful new edition of all the captain's journals plus all the enlisted men's journals with footnotes and explanations and maps and everything.
Caller, you want to say that again, please?
Who has the original journals now, the National Archives?
Oh, no, they're at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia.
By the way, there is a movie about the expedition that came out in the 1950s called The Far Horizon.
Yes.
But I've never seen it on television now.
I've tried hard. It's one of those mysterious stories. Someone from Hollywood probably could answer it. It's not available on DVD. It's not circulated. It's a hilarious. I think Loretta Young plays Sacagawea, and I've seen clips of it, but I don't believe it's available.
Too bad.
Maybe too embarrassing.
Well, it was fictional, I think, to begin with, the story that was told.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've got about 8-9 minutes left in this portion of the program. You know, you mentioned, we talked a little bit about the journals, and the caller asked about the journals. Also, I have a clipping from the Christian Science Monitor that goes back now several months. So it's very interesting. A curator at the Peabody has done some work on artifacts, objects.
Yes.
It's very interesting. And I wonder if you would talk with us about some of the objects we might see at the Newbery and what kinds of things they tell us about the expedition and the relationship between, well, I don't know, the relationship between the Indians and Lewis and Clark, the Lewis and Clark Party, and other things that they might reveal.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me mention a couple. We were very fortunate to have the cooperation of the Field Museum in Chicago, and they loaned us about a dozen, 18 items, and that was very helpful. I should say that there is only one item in the exhibit which is actually from the expedition, and that is the journal of Joseph Whitehouse, who was a private and kept his journal, and it was bound in buckskin, and it is on display. It is owned by the Newbery, and it is on display in the exhibit. But the few items that have survived from that time that were collected by Lewis and Clark, there are a few at Monticello at Thomas Jefferson's home where they were sent, and then there are a few at the Peabody. But the things that we have that I think, the objects tell a story in themselves, one is we have a cedar hat, and the story that I just was telling about the clothing and so on, I mean, you can really see it by just looking at this light, beautiful, waterproof hat, and then hear this Chinook woman telling the story today and sort of laughing about the Americans and their clothing. Case in the exhibit that I think also makes a point in a variety of ways. We have in one case a trade musket, a flintlock musket, like the ones that were distributed by fur traders to Indians, particularly from the Hudson Bay Company, in the beginning at the end of the 1700s and into the first part of the 19th century. Set next to it is a set of Blackfeet arrows and a bow from the Field Museum. And the installers and designers of the exhibit did, I think, a wonderful job of placing them together because they're about the same size. The hunting bow and the rifle are about the same length, The arrows are beautifully decorated, and you can look at those and sort of think about what a bow and an arrow meant in these communities, mm-hmm. how powerful, beautiful they were, and so on. But then you see right next to it this steel rifle, compact and powerful. That incident that I mentioned with the Blackfeet begins with one of the Americans waking up and finding that they had camped together the night before, and he wakes up and sees a young Indian boy. Maybe we don't know, but we're the Blackfoot story is they were 12, 13-year-old kids, had grabbed a rifle and was running away. And you look at that and you can almost feel like reaching in and grabbing it yourself. And so I think it says a lot about the contrast between the two technologies as well as the two traditions.
Yeah. One of the things that I was struck by in this article in the Christian Science Monitor, the curator that I mentioned, Castle McLaughlin, the article ends with this, and this is what we've been about here this afternoon in this hour of the program. She was quoted as saying, "Objects, what they meant socially, symbolically, represent choices of Indian people. They are the voices of those people. That's why these objects and their stories are so important." Yeah.
Well, we were very proud to have these voices in the exhibit, and I think it really both illuminated an aspect of the story that most people are not aware of, but it was also a great act of generosity of these people to share their stories and to realize that these are all part of our heritage, that we're not talking about a chasm between groups, but we're talking about groups of people who all occupy the same continent and really all share the same history.
Yeah. You know, the realization that an exhibition like yours at the Newberry Library can give us that of this part of the story that we've, you know, has been lost in the textbooks. I mean, it's not there. I mean, the answer to the multiple choice question is, you know, A, to get to the Pacific Northwest, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you see that this willingness to take a more complete look at this history, do you think we'll see a rewriting of the text?
Well, I do, and I think something like the concept of the Indian country, it's a very small thing, but if you could imagine people, whether it's in elementary school or later on, learning about the expedition, but before they learn about the expedition, they learn about the Indian country, and maybe there's a multiple-choice question about the Indian country, then it sets the whole thing in a different context, as well as perhaps some of the later parts of the exhibit that we have is we have objects from, and again, this isn't an artifact, but we have a photograph from Associated Press, in 1950, and it's a photograph of the Secretary of the Interior signing an order which took land from the Mandan and Hidatsas to be given to the Army Corps of Engineers to be turned into a dam along the Missouri River. And it's this picture in a formal Washington office building of this man signing a document and a group of Indian tribal councilmen around him who are crying.
Mm.
So seeing the different features of this relationship over time, I think we can broaden the story. And if I may just very quickly to say also that it's been really interesting to me, I spent a lot of time in the West over the past 30 years, how open people in the West have been to bringing Indian voices into this story. This is a real story, I think, of the changing West, of the rising political power of Indian people, and of the ability of this part of the country to become much more diverse and plural and much more open to its plural past than it had been in the past.
We've got just a tiny bit of time left. I'm going to take one more call. Listener in Urbana, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I've heard conflicting reports about the life of Sacagawea after the expedition. I did understand that she had a child and by her French husband, and that the child was educated by Clark, as she had requested. But you may have answered this earlier, and I only came in at the half hour. And so do we know whether she lived a long life afterwards, or do we just lose her in the trail of history?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. The story that most historians accept is that she lived for another, I think, 20 or 30 years, and there is a journal entry from a fur trader in what's now South Dakota in the 1830s, I believe, sometime later, that says Charbonneau's wife died tonight. Or Charbonneau's woman, I think he said. So the general agreement is that she remained with Charbonneau, they remained in the Missouri River, and that she lived, and you're correct about the baby who was born, Toussaint Charbonneau, who was born on the expedition, came back to St. Louis and was educated by Clark. But there is another story, the Shoshones, her people, she was a Shoshone, they tell of her having come back to what's now Idaho and lived into the 1880s and died of old age at that time. And so there is a conflict, particularly between the Indian people in the Missouri River and the Indian people in Idaho. There is this one piece of historical evidence that indicates that she died, but there is also this oral tradition that she lived on.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the listener for her question. And Professor Hoxie, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. University of Illinois historian Frederick Hoxie, he is Swanland Professor of History at the University of Illinois, the author of several books about American Indian history. He's also the curator of an exhibit, Lewis and Clark in the Indian Country, at the Newberry Library in Chicago. It continues through January 14th. 2006. The galleries are open Monday, Friday, and Saturday from 8:15 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday from 8:15 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Their phone number there at the Newberry is 312-943-9090. So if you're interested in going and seeing that exhibition, there you have the number, 312-943-9090. Let's find out now what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. And here's Tom. And now we have Todd. Todd, hi.
Oh, hi. How are you?
That's our boo-boo.
Oh, that's okay. I went ahead and started, but I'll start over again. How about that? December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 297.5 the high. The low at 295, settlement price 297.25. They were up 2.5 for the day. The March futures at 314 high, low at 310.5. And the March at the Chicago Board of Trade soft red winter wheat settled 313.25, down 2.5 cents today. May futures were off 3 cents, 324 the high. The low at 319.5, settled at 322, off 3. And July contract, 333 the high, and the low at 328.75. Settlement price there for the July wheat at 332.5, up a penny in Chicago. And Kansas City, December wheat contract settled at 362. It was down a penny. The high there at 63, the low at 57.5. And the harvest month, July hard red winter wheat, 353 in Kansas on the high, the low at 348.5. And the KCBOT settlement price, 351.25, down 2.25. Now back to the Chicago Board of Trade into the corn pit we go. 190.5 the high, the low at 186.75, settlement price at 187, down 3.75 for the December contract in the corn pit, nearing the low, I think, at 186. Is that right, Dave Dickey? Correct? Dave Dickey tells me that's correct. The low in the Deese corn at 186. March corn, 203.75 the high, the low at $2.25, and a settlement price at 201, staying above $2 for the day, down 3.25 cents for the March contract. May futures in the corn pit, 212.5 the high, low at 209.25, settlement price at 209.5, down 3.5 cents. And July futures, 220.75 the high, low at 217.75, settlement price at 218.25, down 2.75. And September contract, settlement price there for the day, 226.75, down 2.75, the high at 28.5, and the low at 26.5 for the SEPs. Next year's December contract, 240 the high, the low at 37, settlement price at 238.25, down 2.25. Interesting things happening in the oat pit when oats are actually worth more than corn. 209.5 for the December contract on the high, the low at 208, settlement price at 209. That was up a half, and the March contract at $1.95 is unchanged for the day. January soybeans, in the soy complex now, 563, the high, the low at 553.5. Settlement price there at $5.64. They were off 4.5 cents. The March down 3, 571, the settlement price, the high at 70, the low at 61.75. Fairly wide trading range for the day. May futures at 574.5 high, low at 566.25. Settlement price at 575.5, and that was up 4.5 cents for the day. July contract at 579.5 high, low at 572. And a settlement price at 581.25. Well, we'll have to get these numbers from the Board of Trade for the soy complex to you later, simply because they're not right. The highs are, the settlements are higher than the highs, so there's something wrong with the numbers that are coming through. We'll bring those to you during the closing market report this afternoon. December bean meal at 174.70, high low at 172.10. Settlement price at 173.60, down 150 for the day. January futures 174.50, the high, the low at 171.50. Settled at 173.30. They were off 150 for the day. And December bean oil, 21.03, the high, the low at 20.72. Settlement price 21 even. They were off 05. And the Januaries were down 14, 21.25, the high, the low at 20.95. Settlement price at 21.19. And they were down 14 for the day. Quickly taking a look at the soy complex. And the prices, now we have the right prices. Settlements were wrong when we came through the first time. January beans had a high of 563, low at 553.5. Settlement price down a nickel today, 559, the final price for the Jans. The March contract at 570, high, low at 61.75. Settlement at 67.5, down 3.5. And the May futures, 574.5, the high, the low at 66.25. Settlement price, it's 571.25, down 4.25. July beans, 579.5, the high, the low at 72. Settlement price at 77. They were off 4.25 for the day. And next year's November contract down 3. 585.5, the high, the low at 578.5. Settlement price at $5.84, down 3. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, livestock prices finished higher today. January feeder cattle 115.92.5, the high 114.50, the low. The settlement 115.70, that up 37.5. March 115.10, the high 113.50, the low 115.05, the settlement that up 95. April 113.75, the high 112, the low, the settlement 113.60, that up 127.5. December live cattle 93.10, the high 91.75, the low 92.75, the settlement that up 2.5. February 96.40, the high 94.85, the low 95.97.5, the settlement that up 50. December lean hog 62.80, the high 62.15, the low 62.67.5, the settlement that up 2.5. February 66.20, the high 65.12.5, the low 66.05, the settlement that up 25. April 69 even, the high 67.75, the low, the settlement 68.92.5, up 37.5. May 70.70, the high 69.60, the low 70.70, the settlement that up 47.5. February bellies 87.55, the high 85.35, the low, the settlement today for that contract 86.27.5, that down 130. The Dow off 78 points, the NASDAQ off 13, and the S&P 500 is down 9.
Today's broadcast.